Your Honor, my name is David Dansky, registration number 14052. Good afternoon. In November of 2008, the six plaintiffs involved in this case brought claims against a company called Nash Finch, which is a Fortune 500 company based in Minnesota that owns and operates grocery chains. The claims that were brought were claims under the Colorado Consumer Protection Act and the Civil Theft Statute, and some non-statutory claims as well, such as fraud and negligent misrepresentation. The factual gist of the complaints was that Nash Finch had engaged in a deceptive marketing and advertising campaign targeting primarily first generation Hispanic clientele. This marketing campaign had been ongoing for about 6 months. It caught the attention of local media and of the Colorado Department of Agriculture, which raised questions about the campaign. The cases were filed and ultimately consolidated. They were filed in November of 2008. Litigation ensued and lasted for over 19 months. The case, as the trial court found, was vigorously contested. And since the court already has access and can examine the record for itself, I think it's unmistakable to say that this was a major piece of litigation. The plaintiffs have prepared for a 10-day trial set to begin in August of 2010. On the eve of trial, literally on the Friday before the Monday start date, Nash Finch not only paid the maximum amount of available damages under the CCPA and the Civil Theft Statute into the registry of the court, but, and this is significant, admitted liability under those claims, specifically under those claims, thus establishing in fact and in law that Nash Finch had violated both of these statutes, both of these consumer protection statutes. A fee petition was duly filed, and one thing that is important to note about the arguments regarding the fee petition is that there was never any argument that the plaintiff's counsel did not put in the hours they claimed. The defendant's expert conceded that he had no reason to question that the plaintiff's counsel actually did put in the 2,100 plus hours that were claimed in the petition. So this isn't a case where we're dealing with fictitious hours or padded bills or anything like that. After the petition was filed, there was vigorous resistance to the fee request, and basically on two grounds. The first ground was that the defendant alleged that the amount of the fee requested was disproportionate to the amount recovered, which was $4,200, which is the maximum amount available under the two statutory claims, and that the case was essentially over-litigated by the plaintiff's counsel. The plaintiffs asked for discovery regarding the amount of money incurred in legal fees by Nash Finch in the case, on the theory that that was the best evidence, that would be the best evidence indicating how much effort was required to litigate the case from plaintiff's counsel's side.
But that discovery request was, as I understand it, made after plaintiff's expert had already rendered a report. Is that right?
Both expert had already opined. But I think it's perhaps significant to note that it was only after the defendant argued that the case was over-litigated that the bills actually became relevant.
Aren't the bills always relevant in an attorney fees award?
Well, I don't think so.
I mean, I'm not saying the defendants. I'm saying the reasonableness of the plaintiff's attorney fees award is always an issue. So why couldn't you have requested this discovery previously?
Could have been, but I think one has to take into account the way the opponent of the fee petition is framing its arguments, which is the opponent can say, well, the hourly fee, $350 an hour, whatever it is too much. That can be one approach. Or it can say that, you know, for this legal reason or under this factor, you're not entitled to that much. Or it can take the position that the case is over litigated, which is what happened here. At that point, the amount of time the defense counsel put in the case becomes immediately relevant to the issue.
Well, given that it's an abuse of discretion standard, whether the trial court judge has to order the discovery or not, or I shouldn't say has to, whether the trial court judge orders discovery or not, and that the experts were both able to opine, why was it an abuse of discretion for the trial court not to award, to give the discovery in this instance?
Well, first of all, the plaintiff's counsel did not have the perspective of knowing exactly how the defense was going to posture its argument, and had no reason to seek that rebuttal evidence until that argument was presented.
Well, do you have any authority that indicates that the however much money the defense spent on the case is actually relevant to what the plaintiff's attorney should be awarded by the court?
There is no Colorado precedent, but there is a pretty significant federal precedent. Several cases were cited in the opening brief and in the reply brief, which hold that that in this circumstance, when the defendant is, or the opponent of the fee petition is arguing that the case is over litigated, that it is an abuse of discretion on the trial court's part to deny this discovery into the amount incurred by the opponent, on the theory that the best evidence of the amount of time necessary to litigate the case is reflected in both sets of legal bills.
Well, in the cases that you've cited to us, was there a similar circumstance where the both parties' experts had already done their opinions as to whether their fees were reasonable?
I can't say that. I don't think that factual scenario is presented in any one of the two or three cases.
Mr. Dansky, I have a quick question about the mathematical calculation argument. I understand that the lodestar method requires the court to make some determination of the reasonableness of the hours expended. But in this case, due to the block billing, the court was having quite a bit of difficulty. And so under this circumstance, why is it an abuse of discretion to take that block billing percentage discount and take it off the back end instead of off the reasonable hours? Is I think that's the substance of your mathematical calculation argument.
Well, I think I'm not sure whether it's the back end or the front end the court took it off of, but I think that when the court did it the way it did, it presents the problem of double counting. And in this case, that's exacerbated by the fact that the court basically said, I'm going to take off 20%, I think it was, for block billing, 20% for block billing, because in my view, the block billing might disguise some redundancies in excessive conferences. Then the court went ahead and lopped off another 35% for excessive conferences and block billing, excessive conferences and redundancies. So basically, that was double counting.
So your argument is not so much that the mathematical calculation didn't go initially to the reasonable hours, but just that the court did two percentage reductions, one for conferences and one for block billings?
Well, I think there are two mistakes. I think the sequence the trial court used in this case was wrong in that it did not reduce the number of hours by the so-called block billing or redundancies or excessive conferences, but reduce the entire amount by that much, which I think it was just the wrong sequence arithmetically.
Well, that's, I guess, the question that I'm trying to ask, is that if the court's difficulty in applying the correct sequence is due to the block billing, why isn't it abuse of discretion to accept the number of hours originally provided and then just take the percentage off after the fee calculation?
Well, it's an abuse of discretion because the way the trial court did it in this case resulted in a double counting. I think the important point in this case, one of the key points here, is that the trial court exercised its discretion, and I know that's important, an important point to address. The fee award is committed to the reasonable discretion of the trial court, but what does that mean? I think that there's a division of labor. The appellate courts established the legal framework, and the district court applies that legal framework to the facts. An error in applying the legal framework constitutes an abuse of discretion, and that's a proposition of law that this court has endorsed. As noted in a recent case from this court, the trial court abuses discretion when its decision is manifestly unfair, arbitrary, unreasonable, or based on an erroneous application of law.
Mr. Dansky, do you quibble with the trial court, the percentages that the trial court utilized in each category, or are you quibbling with when it applied those percentages?
No. In certain of the categories, in certain of the so-called Johnson factors, deductions should not have been made at all. And that those Johnson factors, those adjustments, are public importance. It was a mistake on the trial court's part to reduce the amount by anything under that criterion, because it was a case of public importance. This was a CCPA case. What the defendant did in this case had a public impact. It was a mistake on the trial court's part to deduct for the amount in controversy. That really was a backdoor way of applying a proportionality criterion, which is not permitted by the decisions of this and other courts. There was a deduction of 12% for non-statutory claims, and in that respect, the trial court ignored the fact, which, by the way, the defendant does not really dispute, that the non-statutory claims that were brought and eventually voluntarily dismissed were based on the same core of operative facts and legal theories.
But isn't the trial court in the best position, and certainly in a much more superior position than we are, to decide whether or not there's overlap in those claims?
Well, I'm not sure if the trial court is in a better position. This is really a legal question. Now, of course, the trial court is more familiar with the record, and I think under either prong of that analysis, the court made a mistake. The court really didn't say it really didn't engage in the operative core of facts analysis, and there's really no basis in the record for the trial court's deduction of 12% for that. There is a basis for some reduction, perhaps less than 3%, because a class action complaint was brought as well, and some time was put into that. But as the trial court noted, that was some fraction of 77 hours, which was really no more than 3% of the hours claimed.
I have a question, and I'll let you answer it, counsel, but about the 77 hours, is there anything in the record that indicates these 77 hours? Or from what I understood from the briefing, that was just a guess on the part of the defendants that it may have been 77 hours.
No, it's not clear how the defendant came up with 77 hours, but when...
Is there something in the record?
Yes, the amount of hours put into the case prior to the filing, prior to the dismissal of the class action complaint, which is about 2 weeks after the individual claims are filed, that amounts to about 77 hours. So I think what the defense did in this case was look at every hour that was put into the case while the class complaint was pending and said, you have to take off 77 hours.
Thank you, counsel. I see that your time has expired.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Andrew Lowe, registration number 11393, and I represent the appellee Nash Finch Company. The most important point, I think, in this appeal is that in deciding the reasonable amount of attorney's fees, the district court engaged in an exercise of discretion, and the plaintiffs have not shown an abuse of that discretion. The single most important factor, which the appellate courts have emphasized over a long period of time in reviewing district court awards, is whether the district court order adequately explains the reasons for its final conclusion and how it got there. Now, in this department, the district court's order in this case excels. I'm sure you've had an opportunity to look at the order, which is 20 pages, single-spaced, and in that order, the court carefully, methodically, describes its methodology and discusses each one of the reductions that the court made. To be sure, some of those reductions were based on estimates, but the ability of a court in this situation to estimate is widely accepted. Indeed, that power is essential because mathematical precision in this context is usually impossible. Here, the plaintiffs also made the district court's job more difficult than usual. For two reasons. First, as I believe it was Judge Boris mentioned in the questioning, the bills by plaintiffs' lawyers, even though they knew in advance that they would have to back up their fee request if they won and submitted a fee request, were block billed. They put one number of hours down for all of the work they did on any given day without specifying how much was for one task or another. So the district court had no way to know how much time the plaintiff's lawyers had actually spent on a particular task.
Mr. Lowe, your opponent makes a good point that the trial court indicated that, you know, the block building made it difficult to determine whether or not there was duplication of efforts and whether conferences were taking place. So why shouldn't we conclude that there was effectively double counting or double reductions?
It's two completely different points, Your Honor. It may seem like double counting, but in fact, the deduction for block billing is a completely different thing from conferences or inefficiencies. It was from the Welch case out of the Ninth Circuit, which cited an empirical study of attorneys' fees or attorneys' bills. So what the study showed was that when attorneys didn't block bill, when they were forced to justify every single task, that they actually wrote down a smaller gross number of hours for each day's work. And the study showed that the range of lower amounts written down when not block billed ranged from 10% to 30%. And so the district court said, I'll give 20% for that.
Mr. Law, I've got a question about that, and it has to do with the sequence. And so if the study goes to the minimalization of the number of hours billed through block billing, why isn't it the correct sequence to take that mathematical calculation when you determine the reasonableness of the hours instead of just putting it as a across-the-board percentage deduction after the hours and the fee amounts are calculated?
In other words, shouldn't the court have taken the 20% deduction as part of calculating an initial lodestar amount and then adjusted from there?
Yes.
Certainly, the court was aware of the lodestar procedure, which it mentioned several times in the order, but it ultimately concluded that it really couldn't fully pursue the lodestar procedure here because that requires the reasonable rate times the reasonable number of hours. Reasonable rate, the judge had no problem with. The reasonable number of hours he had a big problem with. The 20% deduction for block billing is just the beginning. That doesn't get you to a number that is a reasonable number. That just says that if the plaintiffs had done everything they'd done, but they had written down how much time they'd spend on each task, that we can expect the final number of hours to have been 20% less.
Well, the court's order is interesting because it actually discusses a lot of those write-downs in the section where it's talking about how the initial lodestar amount gets calculated. And strangely, perhaps, when you get back to the table where the trial court is actually making the deductions and the calculations, instead of doing those deductions in the lodestar section, it does them in the post-lodestar, adjustments to lodestar. How do you reconcile those things?
Well, first of all, let me preface my answer by saying that the lodestar procedure is not required in Colorado, and there are many appellate decisions which approve district court exercises of discretion in awarding attorney's fees without using the lodestar. But leaving that to one side, the judge here ultimately did not calculate a lodestar as that term is defined in the case law. In order to do that, he would have had to have come to a conclusion as to reasonableness on two numbers. First, the rate, second, the reasonable number of hours. He did the rate, but when he got to the hours, he hit a speed bump because he had 213 pages of billing statements and no breakdown. And rather than going through the really arduous task of, say, okay, on this date, you know, they prepared a witness for a deposition, I think that takes about, you know, 4 hours. You know, that's really a nightmare for a district judge. And the case law, I mean, there are a number of decisions that comment that that kind of level of accounting is not necessary. Indeed, if anybody is to do that kind of accounting, it's really the plaintiffs. They have the burden of sustaining every dollar that above zero that they're to be awarded. And they're the ones who should have gone through their own bills and to have broken it down and given the district court the raw material it needed to calculate a reasonable number of hours.
Well, understanding your comments, counsel, it sure does look like the trial court was talking about whether it indicating that it was trying to calculate a lodestar in its order.
Yeah, the court certainly used the word lodestar, and I recognize that he didn't use the traditional lodestar approach that I've just outlined. I think the court was using lodestar in the sense that he thought of his $500,000 number as his lodestar in a sort of a broader sense. He's thinking, okay, I need a starting point. So I'm going to take their number of hours, whatever they were, and I'm going to adjust their billing rate. That's my starting point. Now I'm going to take all my adjustments on that. And there's no reason why he can't do that. You know, if he'd gone through all the effort to first calculate a much lower fee and then apply additional adjustments to that, there's no assurance that he would have taken exactly the same percentage reductions using a different system. It's totally within his power, his right, to have assigned absolute amounts of dollars to each adjustment. Instead of saying, okay, I'm going to reduce it by 10%, he could have said, well, 10% of $500,000, which was his starting point, that's $50,000. He could have said, okay, I'm deducting $50,000 for that. Ultimately, the district court was the one who was satisfied that the fee that he awarded was correct and reasonable and proper. And he was the one who sat through this entire case from beginning to end and watched all the cases develop and so on. If I could go from those guys start to some of the other issues, or unless the court wishes to continue with that.
I just have one other question, which is related to what you're talking about, the trial court determining what it thought was reasonable. But what did it have as a basis of comparison, especially where it did not allow access into the defendant's you know, the fees that they incurred? I mean, that would have been a good comparison, how much the plaintiffs spend versus how much the defendants spend. If it didn't grant the plaintiffs access to that information, it also probably, the court didn't have that information. So how can you say that it was reasonable or it was not an abuse of discretion?
Well, first of all, the burden is on the plaintiffs, of course, to show that there was an abuse. But leaving that aside, there is a built-in fallacy in using in any way the fees that are incurred and recorded by the defendant's counsel. And that is because we're defending and we have no counterclaims. We have to go wherever the plaintiffs take us. If they want to depose somebody, we have to defend the deposition. If they serve interrogatories on us, we have to answer them. And so to point to the defendant's legal fees and say, well, you know, whatever they were, and say, look at what they were, that kind of justifies the plaintiff's fees.
But by the same token, I mean, given that you ultimately came to a stipulation on liability, that stipulation could have come much earlier, before a lot of fees were expended.
Well, Your Honor, I would ask the court to think back to the beginning. At the beginning of the case, they were sued in a case where it appeared that the maximum liability was $4,200. We had no idea that the plaintiffs were going to run up $790,000 in bills. So when we first made settlement overtures, plaintiffs responded that they already had $250,000 in attorney's fees in the case. And at that point, the case became unsettleable because we certainly weren't going to pay that, and the plaintiffs were not offering to discount their fees. So from there, it just went and went. And frankly, you know, we had little victories as we went along that were important. We backed the plaintiffs into a corner, for example, and got them to voluntarily dismiss, late in the case, two of the remaining four claims, leaving only two for trial. So I would also comment that the district court observed the defendant's conduct of the case. And the district court had no criticisms of the defense of the case. At one point, you may remember that the plaintiff's expert at the attorney fee hearing characterized Nash Finch's defense as scorched earth. And at the hearing, he was forced to eat his words. And he had to admit that, no, this really wasn't excessive. So, you know, this was sort of an ordinary commercial defense of what looked like a very small claim. And it was, I would suggest, it's on the plaintiffs that they ran up a bill that was grossly excessive. I'd like to respond to a comment about the other claims. My adversary said that to make a 12% adjustment for the other claims was wrong because the other claims were all based on the same facts. And he talks only about the class action case being dismissed. But that wasn't just it. That's a small part of it. A larger part of it was that they started with two lawsuits in two different counties, which was completely unnecessary since all of their clients lived in Denver. And then they consolidated them, so of course there had to be litigation at the Supreme Court about consolidation. And they had five claims, only two of which survived. One of them was dismissed as a result of the motion to dismiss. So we have briefing on a motion to dismiss. Then two of the claims that were later dismissed survived for, I think it was approximately a year into the litigation. And so as a result, because, you know, those are common law claims for things like fraud and negligent misrepresentation. For every deposition, you have to think about CCPA, you have to think about civil theft defense, and you have to think about two more claims. So they were taking discovery on two more claims, and we were defending on two more claims. It ratcheted up the cost on claims that they ultimately dismissed. And so the court, knowing all of this, felt that 12% was a reasonable estimate for all of the work throughout the whole case. On the non-compensable claims, if you will, and I might add that the filing of the two claims or the two cases, one in Adams County and one in Denver County, that was no small deal. It's not just that they had to be consolidated. The plaintiffs used the fact that they had two cases to argue that they were entitled, instead of 7 hours to depose each of Nash Finch's witnesses, they said, "Well, we have two cases, so we can depose them for 14 hours, and we get twice as many interrogatories." We had to have motion practice about that. So, you know, these were all ways in which there were parts of the case which had nothing to do with their final success, for which the court felt that they were not entitled to be compensated. Again, the district court was the one who lived through this case and was well aware of exactly what it entailed. And he was satisfied that the final result was correct. And I would suggest that we should as well.
Did you have the same trial judge throughout?
No. Yes, there was one discovery ruling that was ruled on by a different judge, Judge Crabtree, when there was a telephone call in the middle of a deposition. But I believe that the judge in Adams County was the same judge throughout. So I don't propose to continue on and discuss any of the plaintiff's other points. We've covered them all in the brief. So unless there are further questions from the court, thank you. We would request that the judgment of the district court be affirmed.
Thank you, counsel. The case will stand submitted and a written opinion will issue in due course. We appreciate your briefing and your arguments today. And